Adventure, education, and conservation are at the core of the Okavango Guiding School. The school is located in the heart of the Okavango Delta in Botswana, Africa, which has been declared a World Heritage Site because of its pristine ecosystems, its scenic beauty, and abundance of wildlife. Get ready to meet a person who has experienced hippos ramming his vehicle, had a bull elephant tipping 17 people out of a vehicle at night, and spent the next 15 minutes charging them in the dark and trumpeting murderously. Grant has turned those kinds of experience into a beacon in the bush, a private guided training school that provides people with an opportunity to reconnect with purpose and the planet in Africa's outback. He is all about hands-on learning, and his students literally learn from day-to-day experiences like the two I just mentioned. Whether one is interested in experiencing Africa on foot, or in feeling Africa's pulse on a learn-from-experience track, or in finding out about Africa on one's own terms, the Okavango Guiding School has it covered. Oh, the places we'll go on yet another excellent adventure. Stay here with me. Hey, everybody, I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thank you so much for being a part of it. Grant, I am so excited to have you here, and I want to just give a little bit more of an introduction from you as we successfully connected on Skype from Botswana, Africa, if that's okay.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you very much for having me. Great to be on the show.
We are so excited. We were so tenacious in making this happen, even in spite of technology. So let me tell you all a little bit about Grant. Grant Reed has Africa in his blood. From his grandfather, Royce, who was an avid naturalist and a natural tutor to his father, Mike, who spent thousands of hours with his four boys ringing birds, which you have to tell me what that is, catching snakes, finding birds' nests, and noting bird behavior. Grant put up little resistance to embracing this natural world, and by the age of five, he had his own modest collection of snakes and a love of birds. At the tender age of 16, Grant became the youngest senior honorary ranger in the Wildlife Society of South Africa, as well as qualifying as a botanical guide with the National Botanical Institute, and so began his guiding career up to and including the founding of the Okavango Guiding School with his brother Brent. And that's just like, I get excited just reading it. So it's something that I think a lot of us have as a fantasy in our blood. And then you get to do it. I think you're a cross between like Indiana Jones and Jane Goodall. That's what I think of it as. You're studying and you're out there and doing wild and crazy things. And what courage. So thanks for being here.
No, absolutely fantastic. Yeah, I was very fortunate to be born into a family where we always knew what we wanted to do. And, a lot of people... I think a lot of people would love to do something like that, but if you're not born into it, it's quite difficult to find your way there. And sort of being in a family with multi-generations, it's just kind of, we just naturally slipped into it. And yeah, the next generation, my children are already getting into it and catching snakes and got their bird list going. So I think it may be some kind of a genetic defect.
Yeah, it is in your blood. I mean, and thank goodness. I mean, really, thank goodness. And you said, for an up-to-the-minute update, that the winds have been blowing like crazy more than ever. So what kind of impact does that have on what you're doing?
Yeah, it's to be honest, guiding is very difficult in the wind. The animals don't like the wind in their ears. The cats tend to go down, so finding the leopard and lion can be very challenging. The big animals, the elephants, etc., they got nowhere to go. They're out in the open. But guiding in the windy conditions is difficult. And at the moment, we're busy with a trails guide course. So the guys are walking into potentially dangerous animals, tracking lions, tracking leopard. Getting that experience on foot. You know, if you're a safari guide and you're going to be out on foot with people, the first time you encounter a lion or an elephant can't be with paying guests. You have to go through it a number of times with a guide trainer and a mentor. So at the moment on the trail guide course, this poses some challenges. It also can be to your advantage in some of the more sensitive situations where you're creeping up on animals. The sound of the wind can hide your footfall. So if to some extent, it can work in your favor, but for the most part, it actually does make things a little bit more difficult.
And also, I mean, it's kind of a look into the future, because we're certainly having erratic weather, and you as a master guide, it's training people with everything that comes at you, I guess. I mean, I can't imagine, but it sounds very disruptive to me, and I'm glad that I'm not there at this particular time. Even though I think I might be a little bit scared. I spent time in the Amazon jungle in very, very primitive conditions, but I just, some of the things I read about you guys, I'm not sure if I have that much courage. But so here's what I'd like to do next. And I rarely do this, but it's what I want to do. I want to read a quote that really sets the stage for this excellent adventure that you present to people every day. It was a quote from an over-the-top editorial written by Amy Roberts, who's actually the person who told us about you. Yes, and I hope I'm going to meet soon. And then you get to tell the story of the Okavango Guiding School, where it is and what it is and what it isn't. You know, people on our show love stories, and yours is an amazing one. So here's the quote, and it's a little bit long, everybody, but bear with me, because it's worth reading every word. Okay. Anyone who has ever flipped through the glossy pages of a travel magazine or Googled African safari has likely been inundated with images of five-star luxury lodges boasting lavish amenities, treetop massages, gourmet meals, open-air jacuzzis on a private sun deck. And if this type of safari experience appeals to you, the Okavango Guiding School Kwapa Camp is definitely not your place. But for those seeking an authentic wilderness experience, one that will likely put hair on your chest, I love that, Kwapa Camp should be on the top of your list. And I hope I'm saying that right, and if not, feel free to correct me. Kwapa Camp, which I can only assume is, and this is her words, and she said, Botswana, for everything here can kill you. It's like, I was laughing so hard, is nestled on the banks of the Kwapa River in Botswana's Okavango Delta, the ideal setting for those whose tether to nature and nurture is tattered and in dire need of repair. Well, that just cracked me up. So this is not your Ritz-Carlton of guiding school, or glamping, as they call it now. Tell us about the guiding school, what it is, what it isn't. Now it's all yours.
Well, the guiding school started really, my brother and I, Brent, we wanted to, we had a safari business, and we wanted to grow it, and we realized that actually the guides in Botswana didn't have any exposure to training, and there was nowhere formal for local guides to go and study. And at that stage, we're going back now to the early 2000s, the guiding industry in Botswana was dominated by white expatriates coming up from South Africa, guides who wanted to, you know, guide in the wilds of Botswana. But obviously the Botswana government was trying very hard to protect the industry and, you know, get local guides employed. But it's very difficult for a company to employ somebody if they have no knowledge and no history. And obviously a lot of the local people have fantastic bush skills. But the guest skills and developing the knowledge of the birds, et cetera, it just wasn't there. So we started up Okavango Guiding School with that in mind. And what we quite soon realized is that the local people that wanted the training didn't actually have the financial means to get the training. And we realized it was a fantastic opportunity because people from around the world really, really wanted to come and have this hands-on, get your teeth into Africa experience. There's been a paradigm shift in tourism over many years where a lot of people are looking for more adventure. They're looking for more real experiences. They're looking to get their, you know, the dirt between their toes. And we realized that these type of people would love to come on a guide training course. And by being there on the guide training course, we could then offer training to the local people in Botswana that couldn't afford the training at a vastly reduced cost. And so we started these culturally diverse guide training courses. We've been operating them out of Kwapa Camp since 2006. And it's just a very, very remote, very rustic, beautiful little camp that sits on a small river flowing out of the Okavango Delta. And there is absolutely nothing pretentious about it. Up until earlier this year, you instead of flushing with water when you went to the toilet, you were flushing with ash and agricultural lime.
Got it. I've been literally in the rainforest in the Amazon, deep. This was not your tourist boat. That's what we did, and I'm not saying I liked it, and I'm not saying I didn't, but that's what we did. So I get it. But, one of the things that I really couldn't get to the bottom of, and I want you to talk about the different courses as well, because it's exciting. And you're right, there's people like me that might be living through it vicariously, but you never know. I shocked everybody when I went deep into the jungle last year at, 68, 67 years old and loved it. And it was just a life-changing experience. It was my second time in the jungle. But what about people, is it just for people that want to be guides? Because like Amy Roberts, she didn't come to be trained as a guide, did she?
No, we open the training to people who want a life experience. So we have a lot of people who, under the enrichment box, they're coming for enrichment. If you go on safari in Africa, you can go on 20 safaris to South Africa, Botswana, Kenya, Tanzania, and you'll know as much about the bush and the wildlife after 3 safaris as you will after 20, because the average guide doesn't have the opportunity to take guests deeper into the inner workings of how it all fits together. There's so many people out there traveling, doing this fashion travel, going to Africa because it's cool and, going on ever shortened game drives, and it becomes more about the luxury and more about the spas and the saunas, and you've got to get back because of the canapes and all the clutter that gets between you and the wilderness. And it's very, very frustrating for people who want to get deeper. So the guiding school really allows people to come and sit and go through an hour's lecture on the workings of the Okavango, the environment you're in, how the ecosystem functions, and then going out and actually practically seeing how all of that happens, learning about the trees and the birds and the reptiles and the invertebrates and how they all interrelate. So you don't need to want to become a guide. You need to be curious, you need to be hands-on, and you need to have a sense of adventure.
Got it. I really got it. So what, you have different courses, and of course I always have to do my social justice commentary when it comes up, but this makes it more affordable and more accessible, because the thing that bothers me about all of these other things is that it's for the upper middle class that have $15,000 or $20,000 to spend on one vacation. So there's just such, to me, it's the reinforcement of the great divide between people that would really benefit from it and be nurtured and learn and have a life-changing experience that don't have the money. And most people don't have that kind of money to come and do that. But, and it's, to me, it's, I don't want to diminish anything that people experience, but it's a difference between, going to the zoo, the outdoor zoo, that's what it sounds like to me, and really experiencing nature. And there is a part of me that's, it really appeals to. So what are the difference in the courses? You have a nature guiding course and a trail guiding course and bush skills training. What, tell us a little bit about each one of those.
All right, cool. I'll start with the bush skills course, which is really dipping your toe into the waters of being a guide. It's kind of a highlight package of the fun and the cool stuff that we do on both the Nature Guide and the Trails Guide course. We put it out there as a bit of a teaser so that people can see what it's like to be at Quapa Camp, in the hopes that they'll come back and do a longer course. But the Bush Skills course is focused on very practical aspects. So there's not a lot of lectures. Obviously, we do cover the ecology. We go through the important aspects of the wildlife and the bird. But we focus a lot on tracking, on the survival skills, building a shelter, making fire with sticks, the fun stuff. People love to get back in touch with the skills that our forefathers used millennia ago to survive out there. And, you know, it's difficult to explain. You know, it must sound pretty weird to somebody who's sitting in their home, you know, in the middle of the United States, that people will get joy from being able to track a lion or make a fire with sticks. But somewhere deep in us, we still recognize those as important skills. So that's really the bush skills. It's only a week long, and it's, like I said, primarily a very practical course. Conversely, the Nature Guide course is quite a lot of theory component, but we do a lot of it out in the bush practically. So it's a 28-day course. It's broken into two 14-day modules, so people who want to come and do 2 weeks and then come back at a later stage and do 2 weeks can do that, or they can just come for the 14 days and enjoy it. But there we really get into the nuts and bolts of the ecology, the environment. We study the astronomy, the geology, the birds, mammals, insects, frogs, a lot more of it is about communication skills, about guiding, about leading people, about teamwork. The skills of being a guide are universal skills. They're skills that people can use every day in their workplace, which is one of the reasons actually why a lot of people do team building in the African bush, because the skills that guides use on a daily basis are exactly the same skills that you use in a business environment. And then the Trails Guide course is very much a on-foot practical course. It teaches people the skills that the Trails Guides use. So there's a lot of places in Africa where walking safaris are very popular. But walking safaris requires a whole different skill set. So we spend a lot more time studying the tracks. We learn a lot more about alarm calls of animals, listening to the little clues that the bush gives you when a couple of oxpeckers fly up. You know, it's just this little twitter sound that most people wouldn't pay attention to. But as a trails guide, you need to know that that is potentially buffalo, and 10 more steps in that direction could end your life and the lives of the guests behind you. So it's very much focused on those skills. And then walking into potentially dangerous animals. Like I said earlier, you know, if somebody is a guide and they're walking with people, they can't be experiencing something for the first time out there with those guests behind them. They have to have been through it. They have to be the calmest person in that situation. They can't be going, oh my God, I want
to. I'm having angst just hearing you. Yes, they have to keep us all from going crazy.
So we sneak them a little bit closer than you would with guests to give them that experience, so that they know, you know, they need to see what happens when that elephant stops feeding and when the ears stop flapping and the tail cocks a bit sideways and the foot starts rocking. You know, all of those signs, you know, it's one thing to read them in the book, but you have to actually approach with them, with their hearts in their mouths and going, oh my God, this is, you know, they're incredible experiences. But obviously, I must say that it's also done very much with the, you know, with the animal's best interest at heart. We don't push the animals, but we do push the students a little bit so that they can get it. It offers people an insight into Africa that you couldn't ever get going to Africa as a tourist or going as a participant on a walking safari.
So when you're my brain is imploding. It's like this just in. So there's a population that comes to you literally to be trained and get the certification and then go work in other places or even for you as guides, which makes me feel really confident. Like, I'd want to know, where did you go to training school if I'm going out in the safari, out in the sub-Saharan desert with you? Where did you get your training? So is it a certification process that then you can do, like you have received credentials?
Absolutely. So we train on two different platforms. One is the Botswana Qualification Authority, and the other one is the Field Guide Association of Southern Africa, which the acronym is FGASA. So people who leave us, even people who come for a life experience, many of them actually leave with an entry level guiding qualification. So, you know, at the end of the 28 days, they write the exam that you need to write to become a guide. And with that, you have enough knowledge. After 28 days of intensive knowledge, you have enough information in you to know far more than the average tourist that's coming and to be able to impart enough information. It doesn't mean that that person's ready to become a guide, but they've got the entry-level qualification. And if they wanted to go and work in the industry, they would go and sit in the passenger seat next to a more experienced guide.
Right,
right. Go through the mentoring process. But, you know, they come out as an unpolished diamond, but, you know, they're already halfway there.
So for people like me, the bush skills training is what we would go for, where it's a week and you don't have a lot of, you know, heavy content and we're not there to be trained as guides. But is that typically what someone like me, that what I would consider more of a tourist looking for an authentic adventure, would want?
I'm not sure. You know, people are so different. You know, some people just want that time on foot.
Yeah.
You know, they want those experiences of doing the trail guide course. There are other people who are very academic and want to learn more, want to know more. We get a lot of doctors and lawyers, people on sabbatical that want to do something life-changing. A week isn't long enough to do that. And they want to achieve a qualification. I said it earlier, and it's difficult to understand really from somebody who's never going to come back to Africa, potentially never going to use any of the skills. Just the knowledge that they have the skills and they're able to do it, or they're qualified as a guide, just hanging a certificate on your wall to say that you qualified as a guide in Africa is a big thing for some people. And people walk off the course with their shoulders back and their chest puffed out and an amazing sense of self-worth. So I don't really agree. I think there's all different kinds of people out there. We've had a lot of people come and do the nature guide course back to back with the trails guide course, you know, and come and do a solid 56 days out at Quapa Camp.
Wow.
Because they've been working 16-hour days for 16 years. They don't know who they are. They don't know why they're on this earth. They've lost complete touch with, you know, the purpose of life and where they are, et cetera. And, you know, something like this is an ideal opportunity for people to find themselves and for people to reconnect with nature and understand, you know, that, you know, we're all part of it. We've lost our way a little bit, but, you know, out there, you know, there's still our heritage.
No, we've lost our way a lot, and that's one of the problems. There's no connection to the earth, and look what we're doing to it. I mean, clearly, it's just there's no thought about the connection of people's action by hundreds of millions of people, and I think that's a really good point. And that's I keep comparing it to the Amazon because that's the closest I can get. But you are so right, to be away from cell phones, away from computers, away from noise. Away from noise. Just, we are constantly inundated with the din of noise. So to do that, and to spend time with people, like we went with the Achuar tribe in a very small group, just to observe how very softly they speak and how gentle their footprint is on the planet. I mean, and it was funny, we went to a very rustic camp first, and I was literally sleeping on a wooden board with a really thin mat and a mosquito net and something that they called a pillow. I was fine. I slept like a baby. But then we went to a higher-end camp that had a shower, and everyone on the trip said, we wish we had longer time in the other camp. It was so different experience where you wanted to be a part of that experience. It gets you back to where you want to be. So I'd love to know about a typical day, because I have questions. I'm always obsessed with, and I ask this on the air, I've done it many times, about the toilets, because I would assume that's like it is when you go down the Grand Canyon. There's just a hole and a sign, and you take care of that. And then what a typical day looks like. And if you're not that safari with the truck behind you with refrigerated canapes, what does a typical day look like? How do you feed the people based on the size of the group. So tell us, I mean, I want to really literally get down to earth with these questions.
Yeah, you know, we serve pretty wholesome food, but we get up really early. You know, the bush comes alive at dawn, that very, very first crack of dawn.
Right.
The first birds start calling. You know, that's the end of the predator's night shift. And, you know, obviously as a guide, you want to be out then. That's the golden hour. That's the time that you're going to bump the lions while they're still hunting, and leopard and cheetah, and you know, a lot of people coming to Africa, that's what they want to see. The bush is a lot more active during that time. So we get a super light breakfast, cup of coffee, and we head out for about 4 hours into the bush. And usually the activities that we are doing are very much tied into the lectures that we've been having on a trail guide course. It's always focused around looking for potentially dangerous animals. And then secondly, the guided experience, you know, how you would be guiding people. On a nature guide course, you're more often in a vehicle and you come back to camp around about 10, 11 o'clock and have a nice hearty brunch, a couple of hot dishes, some salads, some, you know, vegetarian dishes. And then at a quick lecture time, and then students have time for a little bit of personal time, shower, siesta during the middle of the day, and then some self-study time. 3 o'clock, we have coffee, tea, everything put out. And then we head out into the wilderness, and we basically that afternoon are really trying to tune into what our lectures were that morning, the theory content, and go and show people how that ties in. You know, it's one thing to sit and listen to a lecture. Lectures are important because they give structure to learning. But going out there and actually physically turning over logs and finding the invertebrates you were talking about and physically demonstrating that stuff is equally important. So, yeah, we'll come back. We usually have a little breakout, a little sundowner break where all the students chill out. It's usually been a pretty intense day. And then come back and we have dinner out under the stars. We don't have a structure that we have dinner under. We have dinner out on an old termite mound in the floodplain of the Quapa River. And it's dinner under the stars. And then we sit around a campfire that evening and we chat about the day. We chat about the highlights, what, you know, what made everybody's day, what their most interesting observations were, what they learned. And they just have an opportunity to grill the trainer and, you know, get more information, find out, you know, what the background story of a lot of the stuff is. So it's all very focused on learning. It's not a gentle, soft experience. It's quite intensive, but, you know, for the right type of person, it's absolutely phenomenal.
So do you vet people? Do you tell them, people that want to come, and say this might be too rigorous for you? Or do you figure if someone wants to come and they have the will that there is a way? Does that come up?
No, we're usually pretty brutally honest. You know, if you watch any of our course videos, we send somebody that says, well, I'm not really sure what course I want to do. We send them the nature guide video and the trails guide video and the bush skills, and we tell them in no uncertain terms, this is no this is no holiday. It's not a soft surprise. One of the problems we face is the fact that it is a lot less expensive than your typical safari. So we have to make it very clear that it's not a cheap safari. You know, if you're looking at a safari and that's what you want to do, but you're coming because this is less expensive, you're making a big mistake. Rather look at a cheaper destination like Kruger National Park of South Africa or Kenya, somewhere that you can find what you're looking for at that price. So yeah, we have to be fairly brutally honest with people. We don't like people to arrive and then feel like, well, this is really not for me and I don't want to partake, because you need people to buy into it. You know, you're there as a team, you're there as a group, and the group dynamic is so important. You know, everybody's got to chip in, and you know, we go out and we do a sleep out, and you know, sometimes you'll be sitting up between 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, sitting around the campfire, keeping vigil and keeping everybody safe. So you got to like your teammates, and you got to trust them. And so we make sure that we get the right type of people.
You know, I know I'm going to sound like a rank amateur, but I feel like I earned a couple of stripes going to the deep in the Amazon jungle. And really, it was rigorous, and it was very challenging for me, and I did it, and I'm proud of myself. But do you sleep on the ground? I needed to know that too, or their cots. Sorry. It's like I sound such an amateur, but I would love to know.
They're very valid questions, but don't worry, Gina. So the tents are comfortable. They're 4x3 meters inside, so put into your terms, that's what, about 12, 15 feet by 12 feet. Yeah. Something. They're big enough. They've got straight walls, so you can stand up and walk around inside them. Like I said, now you've got flush baths, you have flush toilets, and, a bit of running water in the basin. So they've been seriously upgraded, much to the disappointment of many of our old students.
I bet. I roughed it, so can they.
To upgrade it. But yes, you do sleep on beds, but once a week or once every 2 weeks, we pack up just the bare minimum, and we either hike out with our stuff or we put them into dugout canoes called a mokoro, and we pole out to another island far away from camp. And there we put up a fly camp overnight, and we sleep on super, super thin inflatable mattresses just with a sleeping bag, and we sleep around the campfire. And the guys will sit up at night and keep watch. So if we've got a group of four or more people, then we'll do a night shift. Otherwise, if we have a smaller group, then the guys have to sleep in tents, because obviously nobody can spend that much time on night duty.
Right.
And you know what?
Right.
It's the most uncomfortable night of their life. But talk to them 5 years later, and it is the single strongest memory that, it sticks out in their minds incredibly. And, what we try to give people is an experience. And if people are not leaving their comfort zone, then it is not an experience. You may as well stay at home, put on the air conditioner, put on DSTV, and, watch Africa from the...
Yeah, watch the Nature Channel. It's like very, very, very different.
You're going to leave your... sometimes it's blisteringly hot, and it can be incredibly uncomfortable, and you can have mosquitoes biting you, and it's not always awesome, but the experience is everything. And we like people to come away having had an experience, not having been completely comfortable the entire time, and not at any not leaving the course feeling at no stage where they pushed a little bit beyond what they feel comfortable with.
And, reading about the trainers, I'm so sorry that Jamie could not be here, because what I read about him, that people have written about him, and what his enthusiasm and his really deep connection, self-taught knowledge of little things that most people ignore. So make sure you give him all my best. And you said he's out somewhere, that they're not having any success with internet in any shape or form. But
yeah, he's up in East Africa at the moment. He's a phenomenal, phenomenal human being. I've had the privilege of working with many, many people over my career in the African bush. And Jamie, and as well as my other trainers, Julian, and Philip, they are very, very special people. And, they're a very difficult breed to find. So we've been very fortunate to have worked with people like that. And, I'm very sorry Jamie couldn't join us.
Well, there could be another time. So it jumped out of the page when you read about him. It's very clear just by the smile on his face. But with the trainers, you live in such a biodiverse area, and you do need great field guide trainers. And from what I read, the trainer doesn't only help you identify the species. Oh, look, there's a lion, which most of us would probably be intuitive and say, oh, yeah, that's what that is. But also interpreting the behavior. This fascinated me. And understanding the complex and fascinating interactions between the species and their environment. And I don't know, you could probably can speak to this, but one of the things that I read about, believe it or not, was the oxpecker and the connection to the giraffe and what you can learn for that. Can you give us an example of how interpret that species behavior and what you learned from watching that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the job of a guide trainer is to take people through an evolution. The what is the very basic question, you know, what is that? And when you first come to the African bush, that is what is interesting. That's an elephant, that's a lilac-breasted roller, that's a lion, and that's about the depth that you get to. And it talks very much to what I was saying earlier about you can go on multiple African safaris and come back none the wiser, because you'd never get to the why. You know, why is this like that? And that's what is interesting. Why do these animals hang around together? What is the oxpecker getting from the giraffe? You know, if you're looking for a certain species, you know, if you're hunting for giraffe, just the call of the oxpecker tells you, you know, we've got two different species of oxpecker. So the one is the red-billed oxpecker, which likes slightly smaller animals with thinner skin and finer fur, and then yellow-billed oxpecker. So simply by hearing the call of the yellow-billed oxpecker, you know you've got a thick-skinned animal, you know you've got something that's more than likely going to be over a ton, ton and a half, and so it limits down to a couple of species. And sometimes you can just see them flying off in a direction, like, guys, we're changing direction. We're going to find giraffe that side. You know, if that's what you're hunting, that's what you're looking for. And you can go around the corner and it can be buffalo. It's like, okay, well, we're going to try again. But, you know, these animals, they give you the clues. If you can speak squirrel and you can speak monkey and you can speak baboon and read buck, you know, the bush is talking to you the entire time. Squirrels give a completely different alarm call when they see a snake, when they see an eagle, when they're seeing a leopard. And if you're not tuned into that, you can miss everything that's happening in the bush. And it can be one call, one little squeak, one little trrr, and it can change your entire morning, because you were going to turn right and you heard this alarm call, you turned left, bang, and there's a leopard with her cubs under a tree. So, yeah, I mean, those interactions are what we try to teach people. And, you know, the value of understanding the interactions. It's not just academic. It actually has a practical value. And like I said earlier, you know, that practical value can also be that you're about to walk into a herd of buffalo and, you know, potentially have, you know, the last few very interesting moments of your life.
That was going to be one of my next questions. But as you tell those stories, it's just about really, really not just listening, but knowing what you're hearing. And I assume that's part of your training. You can't just hear the call. You need to know so much about being literally connected to nature. I mean, it just, to me, it's just absolutely fascinating. So there's the book learning that you know, the curriculum that you can share, but then people have to really be committed to that piece of it, which could be ostensibly one of the most important parts of it. As you said, if a monkey makes three or four different cries based on what they're seeing, you really want to know which one that is if you're going forward. What about you? Have you ever led a group and really been terrified and scared and worried for their safety?
Yeah. I have been terrified before. Absolutely, I've ended up in situations where I wondered how I would get out of it. One of the major reasons, you know, for starting the guiding school and moving forward was the fact that, you know, when we started guiding, there wasn't anything like that. There were no mentors. There were no people to pass on their knowledge to you. You were given a rifle, a vehicle, and a group of tourists, and told not to mess it up, and that was it. And, you know, you went out and you did your best. And, you know, through making a lot of blunders, you learned a lot of lessons, but you got yourself into a lot of situations that you never really had to get yourself into. So, yes, I have been absolutely terrified. One of my earliest guiding experiences was having an elephant throw over my vehicle at night. I was coming back. It was dark. I was stayed out probably an hour longer than I should have, but we found some lions that were mating. I wasn't supposed to be doing a night drive. Couldn't leave the sighting. It was just amazing. These two lions just mating right next to the vehicle and all this incredible audio. And I was a little bit naughty. I didn't have a spotlight with me, etc. And so I was just going back by vehicle lights, and I got halfway back to the lodge and I saw one of the first Mozambique spitting cobras I'd ever seen in the road. which is a type of venomous snake. So I jumped out and grabbed hold of the snake, and I was busy trying to pin the snake's head down and catch it. And there was an elephant standing right next to the road that I hadn't seen because I had no spotlight with me. And the elephant got his fright of his life when this young kid jumped out and started wrangling.
Oh my God.
I didn't know what to do, so I just flung the snake in the direction of the elephant and jumped back in the vehicle and tried to reverse so we could see the elephant. And the elephant just came steaming in from the side, tipped the vehicle over, and basically spilled 16 people out onto the ground in the dark. And there was no canopy on the vehicle, so it was an open vehicle, and the people were screaming, and this elephant ran off, and then he ran back, and he charged us, and I had my rifle, but I had no idea really what to do with it. You know, I hadn't been through any, you know, significant rifle training, and, you know, a gray elephant in on a dark gray night doesn't exactly stand out as a target.
I'm just like...
and screaming and kicking up dirt in front of me, and I was saying dreadful things to it in Afrikaans, one of the languages we grew up with. And he ran off, and then he turned around and he came again and charged right up, stopped literally 3-4 meters from me, and put on another massive display. And I honestly thought I was never going to walk away from that situation. I really didn't know what to do, and you know, stood my ground, and thank God the elephant turned and ran off. And a few hours later, we had no communications with camp. So a couple of hours later, a vehicle came past and picked up my tourists, and the next day we recovered the vehicle. But yeah, there've been a number of times when I honestly felt like, you know, these are my last moments.
That's just like, talk about being on the edge of my seat. It's really, and it was not caught on camera, but you could not even replicate that. That's what, like, you either dream about or have nightmares about. I'm not sure which, but that's an incredible, powerful story. And thank God, you talked earlier in the show about the guide's responsibility is to, you know, in this case, fake it till you make it, because you were scared stiff, but you knew what to do. You know what I mean? You knew what to do. It's like, yeah, so I'm the guide. All these people are in my care. I better act like I'm not scared and get in that elephant's face. I can't even imagine, especially since elephants are so massive. So I'm very happy you're here to tell us the outcome of that story. Another thing that just, like, I feel like we should have, like, a moment of silence while I catch my breath, because that's pretty incredible and fun that you shared it because of the ending. Did anybody get really hurt?
There was one person who sort of had quite a bruised coccyx, and another person with a sore lower back, but nobody with any real injuries at all, remarkably. It was so lucky.
And I know this sounds ridiculous, but at some level, because of the outcome, I'll bet they tell that story for the rest of their lives because they survived. Seriously, it's like, it's a thrill of a lifetime because I got to live right in the moment. I'm not sure how thrilling it was, but that's what makes the most special part of the trip. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, you really do help local people, as you said, local citizens, and your goal is to put a local citizen on every course to be co-trained along the international students. Do people that are coming and paying help support that model, or can people sponsor a guide? How does it work financially so that you can able to do that? It's so amazing and wonderful and praiseworthy. If you're me, I think that's like the way it should be, but how do you make it work?
So we have a three-tiered system, really, where the international people pay, you know, significant value to come and have this experience. But that said, you know, if you spend 2 weeks on the guide training course, that 2 weeks you would spend, what you would spend on that 2 weeks would buy you about 2.5 days in the nearest luxury lodge.
Right.
So
right.
It is inexpensive, but in comparison to the luxury lodges of Botswana, it's really cheap. And that allows us to have a lot of African guides who are working, who are in the industry, who have a little bit of money, to pay significantly less for the course and still make it economically viable. And then we have one space on every course which we reserve for a sponsored student, somebody who has no financial means to pay for a course. They come to the guiding school, they're desperate, they want to find out how to become a guide. You tell them the price, they go, oh my God, there's no way I'll ever afford that. So we then have a structured interview with them, and we choose the brightest and the best, the men and women who have what it takes to be a guide. They're intelligent, they're well-spoken, they're people's people, they're conservationists. They've got that amazing African smile. I mean, the people in Africa, I don't think anybody can smile like our people here. They've just got the most phenomenally disarming smile. And you know what it takes, you know, having been a guide for many years, you know the attributes. And we look for people like that to put them into the program. And then after the training course, we'll try and help them to find placement as a learner guide once they've got their guide's license through us. But it's an incredible experience. You know, we have a lot of people from around the world that come and do this course, and they train for 28 days alongside this local person. And they become friends on Facebook, and they keep in touch by email. And 3-4 years later, that person who was on a course with us brings their family out to Africa, and they go and do a 12-day safari with the guide who they trained with. And,
they become
friends because, you know, they've had that experience. And I think one of the greatest unseen benefits of this, we never saw it coming, but one of the byproducts of this sponsorship program was the fact that people actually got to come to Botswana and really, really understand Botswana culture. You know, when you come here, the person who's at the hotel desk or the waiter who's serving you in the luxury lodge, you know, they're professional people, and you don't cross the professional divide. So you don't really get to understand and chat to them about how they grew up and, you know, their grandfather, how he used to hunt and trap fish and do this. But because these people are now all on one tier, they're on one level, everything is stripped away apart from you're now in the wilderness together. There's an amazing opportunity to really delve into the culture and understand the cultural history of Botswana and Africa as a whole. And I think a lot of people get a lot more out of the experience because they're not just coming and learning about the wildlife. They're actually learning about the people who have inhabited the Okavango Delta for many thousands of years.
Yeah, it just gives me chills, almost everything you talk about. So I'm sure that you would agree with me that ecotourism, that phrase, is one of the most abused catchphrases ever. I know you're laughing. I know. I figured you'd laugh at me. So talk about what real ecotourism is and its minimum impact on the environment. What is it to you and your team?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Gina. I think, you know, people should be shot for what they do under the ecotourism.
I agree. It's like a joke.
And a lodge, then it's ecotourism. And people have lost sight of what ecotourism is. You know, to me, ecotourism is culturally responsible. It's socially responsible, and it's environmentally responsible. And if you're not ticking all of those boxes, then it's not ecotourism. You know, we realized in Africa a long time ago that unless the communities that surround our wildlife areas are seeing real benefit, not a couple of pennies here and a couple of pennies.
Right, really superficial, just a nod. It's more real impact.
If they're not getting that, they are not going to protect those areas. And we've seen over many years of doing anti-poaching, there is no limit to the number of foot soldiers that will go out and poach rhino and poach elephant. And you can catch them, you can arrest them, you can torture them, and you can shoot them all day long. You don't break the chain. You know, there are millions and millions and millions of poor people in Africa who are making a life and death decision for their family, that I need to feed my family. This guy's giving me money to go and shoot an elephant. Hell, I would do it. I've got two kids, and there's nothing I wouldn't do to keep my kids alive. So, you know, unless we change the whole conservation model and we accept the fact that, you know, we have a cultural and a social responsibility to spread that wealth, we're not going to get anywhere, and we're going to keep on fighting and losing the same battle. So, yeah, I mean, that's really what ecotourism is about. And, you know, the environmental sustainability talks for itself. You know, your footprint needs to be as small as it possibly can be to achieve what you need to achieve to conserve that area. There is always going to be some kind of a footprint because you need people to have an experience. But, you know, when we started Quapa Training Camp, when we first moved into that area in the early 2000s, it was poached, almost devoid of wildlife. And just by being there, just simply our presence, the driving around, we had to create a few game drive networks, obviously, to get around. That is, you know, that's a footprint on the environment.
Right.
But the reward of that footprint is that the poachers no longer knew where we were going to be, and we were moving quite fast different distances from one place to another. And simply by being there, we've protected the animals, and what we've seen is an incredible recovery of the wildlife there, where it is now teeming with wildlife. You know, we're seeing leopard every other day. We've got rhino in the area. There's, you know, bigger and bigger herds of elephants and buffalo, cheetah, lions are coming back. The hyenas that were poisoned almost to extinction, they're coming back and starting dens, etc. So that to me is ecotourism. And I think everybody who's planning a holiday to Africa owes it to themselves to visit one marginal area. You know, you can, you know, if you want to knock yourself out, go to a couple of luxury lodges, but then go to somewhere that's doing some good. Go to somewhere that is, you know, may not be the most comfortable, you know, stay that you're going to have, but go and support a lodge that is in a marginal area where just by them being there, you know, they are supporting conservation and supporting their surrounding community. I think we as a, you know, we as a human race have to become a lot more responsible about what we do and how we do it. And I think that's got to be a question we ask ourselves, is what is the impact of my next holiday going to be? Am I going to be doing good, or am I going to be doing harm? Anybody who flies over the ocean to go on a holiday is already, you know, got a massive carbon footprint.
Right, right.
And you know, you should be looking at doing something to mitigate that.
It's just, to me, so incredible. I mean, I'm awestruck because we forget about that. People go and they pay enormous amounts of money for companies that make lots of money, and there's not this, what I call, social justice component to it. It's their land. It's where they grew up, and people come in. We hardly see that anywhere here in the United States, says she with tongue in cheek. Where come in and it's all messed up in my head about white privilege and not really being connected. And you're so right. It's just about connection, not just to the environment, but to the people who live there. And I would do anything as well to feed a starving child. I have children. I would do anything. And we see the pictures and the horror and try to support anti-poaching efforts. But basically what you're saying is, by your very presence and by doing what you're doing, it's an anti-poaching, it's an antidote for that. So it makes me very hopeful about having people like you out there. So my last question is about climate change. You know that our mission is to raise awareness in any way we can around climate change. And what I try to educate people about on my other shows is it really begins, you know, I say climate change is an inside job, and it starts with consciousness about your footprint, about connecting to nature, about what you consume, about the waste, about the chemicals that you're producing, all of those things. But climate change, as we are seeing, in the United States now with the devastation of the forest fires. I mean, the wildfires. It's the likes of which we have never seen. The record-breaking deaths and devastation in high concentrated areas. I mean, lots will change because of this latest round of fires in California. And it's winter. So when we get closer to summer, now we have year-round fires burning in the United States. What are you seeing? I mean, you're a person that lives it, eats it, sleeps it, drinks it. Your family's there. It has been for generations. Are you observing severe, mild? Tell me about global warming, climate change, what you're seeing.
I think we're seeing, like the rest of the world, I don't think there's anywhere that's not experiencing massive climate change. What we're seeing is longer, hotter, drier summers. So we're a little unusual if we don't have a spring. We go from winter straight into a drier summer where it goes from being fairly cold to hot as Hades. And once the furnace gets turned on in middle August, we'll see our first rain very often in middle November. But that'll be one isolated thunder shower. And with that, the bush starts to green a little bit. But, you know, there's those first rains that really provide the nourishment. A lot of our antelope are tuned into having their young a little bit earlier. And, you know, the mothers are now forced to eat very, very dry food, which is a very low crude protein. They're unable to do anything. They need to drop their young. So there's a lot more pressure on the wildlife that are in tune and have been for millennia. You know, they've evolved over millions of years with the climate as it is now. And I think one of the biggest risks we face is that with things changing this fast, evolution is a very, very slow game. And I think we're seeing a lot more pressure on our herbivores. And of course, carnivore populations follow herbivore populations. So, you know, if the herbivores start struggling, you know, 3-4 years later, there's a lower prey base, and so you get lower carnivore numbers. Our lions are down from over 100,000 lions that we had 20 years ago down to 20,000 lions we have now. So, you know, it's a serious concern. Anything that threatens those species is, you know, it's a threat on top of another threat on top of another threat. So absolutely, there is climate change. I think we're seeing more erratic floods. I think when we do get rain, it's harder. It's more intense, and it is less fulfilling to the environment because there's a lot more runoff. There's a lot less soaking in. So the rain that when we do get rain, although there's a lot of it, it tends to flood and doesn't really nourish the bush as much as it does. So it's difficult to quantify, but you know, those would be my observations.
Well, and that's where it starts. I mean, there is the part here in the United States about encroachment and all of the things that the impact that it has on the environment. But there, in an area that's not so populated with buildings and so many people, you get to really observe how it's impacting us up close and personal. And it's, you know, I read an article the other day, which I haven't totally vetted, about the Amazon rainforest is no longer capturing carbon. It's at saturation point, and that does not surprise me. I have to read more about it before I spread that word, but it's just happening to people. And instead of spreading fear, we just want to spread awareness and consciousness about your footprint. So this has been beyond delightful for me. And I mean that. It's so affirming and so nurturing to me. And I cover a lot of really painful topics about the impact of climate change in both the natural and social justice arena. So thanks for making my day. And I really don't say this lightly. You planted a seed in me, and I am an adventurer. I got the nickname of Badass on the trip to Ecuador because I wouldn't stay in. I did everything. Like everything they offered, I was there. And you, it was unbelievable. And like I said, it wasn't a tourist group. It was people really committed to the preservation of the rainforest. So thank you. And I'm going to thank Amy for bringing it to Kelly's attention. and you would not have crossed my path. So I hope that I get to shake your hand someday in person. And I'm going to see, I'm going to the Galapagos in 2020. And that's just much more of a tourist thing, because that's pretty much the only way you can go there now because it's so restricted. But we picked the best that we could do in terms of being connected with nature. So that was a very long thank you on my part, but I hope you know it was heartfelt.
One last thing, because you did ask me a very pertinent question and I didn't fully address it. And that relates to sponsorship of guides.
Yes, thank you.
To sponsor guides. So you know, we do have a lot of people coming to us looking for somebody to support. It costs in the region of about $2,800 to put a local guide onto a 28-day course and give them a leg up into the industry. So, you know, we'd love to hear from anybody who would like to support a local student in Botswana. And, I really want to say thank you to you for all the work that you do. It's fantastic to be able to talk to somebody who's like-minded and somebody who's getting the message out there. It's, we do our little bit here in Africa, but it's very one-on-one. And it's great that people like yourselves are talking to bigger audiences and making the change that is going to make a better planet for my kids. So I thank you from the bottom.
But thank you. But let's stay with that sponsorship model for a minute. Is there a link on your website? That's not a lot of money for lots of people. $2,800. Is it a tax deductible contribution? People would ask that. Or some people don't care about that. Even people that have given us money to, you know, rebuild our website, they believe so much in our mission and they have means. So yeah, here's the money. Wouldn't it be so great if you called me or sent me an email in 3 months and say, we got three people sponsored because of your radio show? I would be doing the happy dance. How do people do that?
You can contact us through the guidetrainingcourses.com website. This is www.guidetrainingcourses.com, or just send an email to info@guidetrainingcourses.com.
Okay. And I just want to remind everybody that's listening while driving or can't write it down, everything that any of the guests say about where to go are in our show notes once the podcast is put out. So you don't have to remember anything other than to listen to the podcast. We'll put that link on. Kelly is like hyper vigilant about that. But I'm just going to manifest that somebody says, yeah, that's something I want to do. How wonderful that would be and how affirming to me and to our work from the Mrs. Greenswirl team. So you're making my day here at 7 a.m. in the morning. And like I said, we shall see. I'll be really mulling this over and hoping that I can see you in person. And everybody, this is our one of our last shows of 2018, which I find hard to believe. So we want to, with each show, say have very blessed and consciously lived holidays. Please don't make it about buying a bunch of crap for your kids and overpackaging. Amazon doesn't need the money, trust me. And what your kids will remember is meaningful experiences, not what box they got to open. And I've asked my kids, and I have grandkids, and it's all about being present and spending time and creating laughter and gathering around meals. So try to cut down on your waste. This family will not be wrapping many presents. I can tell you that. Our presence is going to be, we're buying games so that we can play more games. So our one of the last shows is really going to be an important show for local and national guests. It's on December 13th with a man named Jeff Christensen, and he's the CEO at a company called Encompass Health. And he's talking about how to select a rehabilitation service. And when I read about it, they're apples and oranges. And there's a lot of for-profit companies out there that will fool you into thinking you're getting something when in fact you should be educating yourself about what real rehabilitation services are. So I hope you'll tune in for that. And then for the rest of the year, we're going to do some of our greatest hits. We've had an amazing, I love to say kick ass because I don't think it's a curse, but we've had some really, really amazing guests. And it's hard to pick which ones we would replay for our greatest hits. So make it safe and very consciously lived holidays. And Grant, thank you again. I really am getting excited. And my husband is the board op and he's sitting here grinning, knowing that the seed has been planted. And the next thing you know, I'll be saying, honey, I'm going to Africa. And I hope that's true. Thank you so much.
Thank you.